Hey, you guys, Shotgun Storyworthy is back. It's the third Friday of each month at IO West on the main stage.
The next show is Friday, April 18th at 7 o'clock. It's an all play, so come on down and spin that wheel.
That's right, folks. Everybody gets to play. And you know, Hannes, it's happy hour, too.
And admission is free. So
what?
You can spend all your money on drinks and then come up and make a fool of yourself. It'll be great.
It's a win-win situation. We'll see you guys Friday, April 18th at 7 o'clock at IO West.
Hey, folks, this is Hannes Finney from the Storyworthy Podcast, and we want to thank you for your support. We want to thank you for listening. And you know what? The only way for us to grow is for you to tell your friends, tell your family, tell people you don't even like. We need you to get the word out there about Storyworthy. And we thank you.
We thank you.
We thank you.
Hey, you guys, this episode of Storyworthy is brought to you by GoDaddy. Don't let someone steal your great idea. Register a domain name now and put your idea online. GoDaddy's offering OneNew or Transfer.com for the low price of $2.95. So whether you're building your dream business or starting a website for fun, visit GoDaddy.com and enter the code STORY295 at checkout. Some limitations apply. See website for details. Don't forget, you guys, visit GoDaddy.com and enter the code STORY295 at checkout, and you are supporting this podcast.
I'm Dylan Brody. You're listening to Storyworthy, which is sort of a shame, because if you could see Storyworthy, you would know that Christine Blackburn is cute.
Hey! Welcome to the Storyworthy Podcast. Here are your hosts, Christine Blackburn and Hannes Finney.
Welcome to Storyworthy. My name is Christine Blackburn, and I'm here with
Hannes Finney. We're coming to you from Ripley's Believe It or Not Museum on Hollywood Boulevard.
Now, that's only like 2 miles from my house, so that's convenient.
It is. You actually walked over here in your walking shoes. You were doing your Olympic walking thing with the poles.
I live in Los Angeles. I'm not walking. I'm not archaic.
I'm trying to create a word picture.
Okay, so why are we here, Hannes?
Because our subject tonight is Hollywood mythology.
Mm-hmm.
And mythology to me is one of the things that is represented here at the Ripley's Believe It or Not Museum.
Now, Hollywood mythology, but here at the
that
Ripley's...
That tends to, yes.
Yeah, but I mean, here at the Ripley's Believe It or Not Museum, it's more like the tallest man and the shortest
right.
bear.
I would assume that our guest, Dylan Brody's Hollywood mythology, it has to do with, you know, movie stars and something like that. But I can't be sure. It might have to do with the tallest man in the world.
We don't know.
It might have to do with the smallest man in the world.
Well, I'll tell you something. I'm very excited. He's here. You guys, Dylan Brody, he is an award-winning playwright. And I'll tell you something. You know what he is, Hannes?
Steampunk?
He's a linguist savant.
Ooh.
I'm
that sounds
you,
fancy.
He takes the words
it.
And he makes them into beautiful pictures in different ways.
Wow, we should really try and do that, too.
Well, I'm super happy he's here, you guys. Dylan Brody, and his subject is Hollywood mythology. And you know, Hannes, it made me think immediately of some famous Hollywood myths that are not real.
Yes.
And here's
such
a couple.
As.
Number one, when you think Hollywood myth, what do you think of right off the top of your head?
That Ronald Reagan was supposed to play Rick in Casablanca.
Is that right?
But it wasn't really. It was just they were considering it. When Casablanca was a script, then it was like on the B level.
Yeah.
They were like, well, we can get Ann Sheridan and we can get Ronald Reagan. And then when it moved up to an A level, they were obviously never going to put. You
so
know,
that
they,
was that's mythology then.
It's a yeah, it's sort of one of those myths that springs up where they're like, oh, they almost didn't do this or they almost didn't do that. They have a lot of those things.
Okay, how about Richard Gere and the gerbil?
Yes, Richard Gere and the gerbil. Is that mythology or is
now
it
that
really
has
hot
been a rumor
porn?
Since the early 90s?
Yes.
And they claim, of course, that Richard Gere went to Cedar Sinai Hospital to have a troubling cavity removed.
From his colon.
Yes, a gerbil. But nobody seems to be able to ever track down that report. And according to Sylvester Stallone, Gear blamed him for starting the rumor after those guys had a fight.
Oh, I was unaware of that. He started that. Well, Sylvester Stallone, of course, there's a famous story about him, which may or may not be true, which is that he's in his trailer.
I love this
you
story.
You know the story? Yeah, he's in his trailer. And he's got a, you know, the thing that you crazy civilians who aren't in show business don't know is they put a microphone on you. And it's like, it's
you
your job.
You are mic'd for the day.
For the day. You don't take the mic on and off. So it's your job to unplug
monitor.
It or turn it on and off.
Right.
So he leaves his microphone on. He goes into the thing, and then everyone on the crew hears him go, work the balls. Work the balls. That's the famous phrase that was just going through everyone's headphones on the set.
Here's the thing with that sort of mythology, whether it's true or not, it's just a good story.
It is just a good story, and
here's
I like the idea.
Here's another one. Jane Mansfield, the famous sex bomb from the, what would you say, the 50s, right?
The 50s.
They say, you know, she was killed in a car accident, and people seem to think that she was beheaded.
Yes.
And that some even claim that her signature scarf that she always wore pulled her head off when it got stuck in the accident. But none of that is true. Jane Mansfield was wearing a wig when the accident happened, and the wig flew off and was mistaken by witnesses to be her head.
Ah, I see. Yes, I have heard this one. Now, you know who her daughter is? The star of SVU.
Yes.
SVU. I have to think about it before I...
Wait, yes. What's her name again?
Mariska Hargitay.
Mariska Hargitay, that's right.
And her father was Jane Mansfield's husband, who was, I believe, Mickey Hargitay, who was the Arnold Schwarzenegger of the 1950s. He was a bodybuilder who became an actor.
I thought that was Jack LaLanne.
Well, he was famous, but he wasn't in show business. So it was imagine if Arnold Schwarzenegger and Lonnie Anderson had a child. That's who Mariska Hargitay is. Yes.
Okay, here's another myth. Marilyn Monroe wore a size 16 or a size 12, depending on what country you're from. Either way, that's very much heavier than any of today's starlets. However, that is not true. Marilyn Monroe was actually a size 2 or a size 4.
In today's sizes,
her waist was actually disproportionately smaller than her bust and hips, and her dresses averaged a 22-inch waist. 22-inch waist.
Jesus.
And 34-inch bust. So she was, basically a size 2 or 4.
Yeah, they're always like, and the thing is, though, even with that, when you look at her, you're like, she would now be considered a giant fat cow, which is insanity.
Insanity.
Because these, and Christine can attest to this, when you see these actors, and it's not just women, the men too. They are the smallest people on the face
actors
of the earth.
Actors are tiny people with big heads.
Yeah,
that's
and
true.
They have like no body fat, and it's just freaky.
How it adds weight. It does. It
yeah,
is interesting.
It does. I know. I hate that.
All right, here's another one. The Amityville Horror. The fact that it was a true story was a huge selling point for the book and then later the movie. Remember the Amityville Horror, Hannes?
But?
About the Lutz family after they bought that haunted house in Amityville, New York. But when the movie was released, the lawyer defending the original murderer was really pissed off because apparently the Lutzes originally agreed to write the book with him, and according to him, they made up the entire story together. The Lutzes eventually ditched him for a better deal. Apparently, they hadn't fled the house in terror so much as the inability to pay for it. So basically, the Amityville Horror was not haunted after all.
Right, and it was just all bullshit. Well, what about have you got the
great story though? I'll tell you something. Remember, there was a pig in the girl's room.
So you're a horror movie person.
I
don't like horror movies. I never. I'm too much of a I would actually like a nut. I would listen to actual horror stories like from, you know, what was happening in the real world. I didn't ever want to go on a horror story site. Do you have the Munchkin one in there?
No, but I'm not going to like it right off the bat. I don't care for the Wizard of Oz. I don't care for Munchkins. I don't care
right,
for any
the of famous idea that there is on film a little person playing a Munchkin who had hanged himself in the back of the set and that you can see it on film. But when you look at the film, if you look at the freeze frame, that's what it looks like initially, but really it's just an illusion of the trees. But for 30 years, they've been like, 30 years, 70 years, they've covered up a suicide on the
Here's something set. I want to talk about. Okay, so we just talked a lot about Hollywood mythology, but I don't know if Dylan Brody is coming at the angle of this that we just talked about, because I never ask for the stories up front. I don't want the story where these storytellers to tell me the story. I want to hear it fresh.
Yes.
However, I'm being back and forth here with this story Dylan Brody gave me because it could either be about what we just talked about or he might be going on the angle that people in the world seem to think that if you are talented and you will work hard, it will pay off. And that is, in fact, not true. People think, well, you know, I'm talented. I'm going to move to L.A. I'm going to work my ass off. And I know I have talent. So therefore, an audience will find me. They will like me. They will be interested in me.
Right.
I will be in the entertainment industry.
And the part that nobody wants to talk about.
and I will be a product for sale, right? And I will be, because I have the goods. In other words, I bring the product and I deliver and I have, and so that should add up. But in fact, the mythology of that is it doesn't add up.
Because luck plays a gigantic part. And everybody in show business knows dozens of people who are incredibly talented that you, the general public, have never heard of.
There's so much
talent in this town. It's crazy.
It's not called show art, you know, Hans.
Yeah.
It's called show business.
Yeah.
And it really, it'll bring you down, though, because then you think about business. You think, like, well, if I'm good enough in this business, then I'll get ahead. But that's not true either. In other words, if I want to be a doctor, I can do enough schooling and make it happen, and I will be a doctor. But in show business, it doesn't matter what conservatory you went to. It doesn't matter where you come from. It doesn't matter if you are the son of a star or a daughter of a star. It may or may not happen.
Yeah,
so it sucks.
Right, exactly. But that's what makes it all worthwhile. But it's just
you're saying luck makes it worthwhile.
When you actually make it, when you make it in any level. See, the thing is that I think the definition of making it to us when we were kids or to the general public is you're so famous, people know your name, or you have your own show. But the reality is, we personally know people who make a decent living at show business and work all the time, and nobody's ever heard of them. They're those people you're like,
that's
I've seen that guy, and it's like, it's perfectly okay.
That's a good
to
place
be that
be.
Guy. That's
absolutely
that's an awesome
you
place
to be. Just
want to
be a working actor or a working person in show business. Just want a podcast that pays me money.
Oh, well, now let's not go crazy.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Podcast is a Latin word for black hole in which you throw funds.
Hey, listen, Storyworthy, we've been doing better and better, as you know, Hannes.
That's true. Money is actually coming in. And you can be a part of that.
Well, I thank every single person out there who listens to the show. We do appreciate it. And, you know, the biggest way we get our name out there is word of mouth. So if you can tell a friend or a coworker or somebody in your family about the Storyworthy podcast, you see how that perpetuates itself, Hannes.
Right. And tell them to go on storyworthypodcast.com, click on our Amazon ad, buy whatever horrible pornographic thing that we're gonna buy anyhow, and we get a taste.
All right, you guys, we do have a real storyteller here tonight, and we're gonna find out what he means by Hollywood mythology. So don't go anywhere. Next time on Storyworthy, we have comedian Penelope Lombard.
And I'll be talking about the trouble I got into in Florida.
That's next time on Storyworthy.
Hey, folks, guess what? Storyworthy is now dropping twice a week.
Twice? What, does this mean more work?
It's double the work is what it is, actually. But two brand new true stories coming at you every week from the Storyworthy podcast.
I guess that is good because that's twice as much me.
Twice as much me.
I'm sorry, my earphones are cutting out. What did you say? So tell your friends, tell your families, tell your enemies, tell everybody. Twice a week. Twice.
This is Dean Hagler from Chilpack Hollywood Hour. And I don't mean to spread a conspiracy theory, but you're listening to Storyworthy.
And we're back. We're at the Culver Hotel outside of now Sony Studios, formerly MGM, where the Wizard of Oz was in fact filmed. And this is where all of the little people played Munchkin stayed. And that's part of the Hollywood mythology is and this was true, they had the most debauched parties that Hollywood had ever seen. Just naked little people drunken, running through the hallways of the Culver Hotel.
I can't believe you just put that in my mind. Why did you do that?
It will never leave. It's like the Amityville Horror for you.
Oh, my God.
Drunken, naked little people.
Thanks, Hannes.
Yeah.
All right, you guys. Dylan Brody is here right now. He is an award-winning playwright, a humorist, a screenwriter, and a poet. He has 5 CDs to his credit, along with 3 novels. You can find his essays in the Huffington Post and on his blog, Dylan Brody, purveyor of fine words and phrases. That's at dylanbrody.com, and you can find him on Twitter at Dylan Brody. Folks, wherever you are, put your hands together for Dylan Brody.
I love the idea that you have people wherever they are putting their hands together. I like to imagine that your audience actually applauds in their homes as they listen, or in their cars, which can be dangerous. Most mythology, if examined closely, becomes patently absurd. In Hollywood, the mythology is that talented people can come here and get discovered. For that to be true, there would have to be people in Hollywood waiting around to discover other people. Those people do not exist. I hadn't thought it through that far, though, so I moved here. I was 23 years old, and I showed up at the table imagining that I had already proven myself so talented that surely someone would have saved me a seat among the cool kids. My father, a professor of English and theater, had taught me that the key to a career in the arts is to just do your work and keep your head down. If you're any good, he said, people will notice. I had a Xeroxed screenplay and a tight 20 minutes of well-honed stand-up material. In my film-fed fame and punchline fantasy, that meant I had an all-expense-paid ticket upslope to the thrill-a-minute black diamond run of household name and paparazzi dazzle. I had gotten here, and having done so, thought I'd certainly arrived. We know the industry is all about the multicolored shadows cast oversized on white walls, sequential snapshots given life only by our insistent persistence of vision, two-dimensional images endowed with depth by our imaginations. We know these things, but we forget. We forget that glamour is the work of witches and wizards designed to send the noble and chivalrous hero off course, not the actual object of the quest. We forget the basic underlying lesson of all the fairy tales, the one every one of them points to, but none specifically articulates. We forget that nobody finds the heart's desire, nobody gets to live in the castle on the hill, nobody gets to live happily ever after, until all the illusions are shattered and everyone is disenchanted. I remember being at the edge of a party, hoping for a hit of pot, a line of blow, anything to make me feel part of the action and not apart from it. Huddled, clutching to my aching, lonely chest the knowledge of my tight 20 minutes, nothing but setup and punchline, I hoped for a chance to show them all how funny I could be. Opportunities fell away as stammering screenplay stuck to the roof of my mouth. I pitched hard against the tide of my own rising potential. Grasping at fantasy, I allowed my clumsy, lumbering shadow to obscure the truth. This was my plight. This was my youth. This was my shame. I watched people laughing lightly, confident, and casual, while I made mental leaps that took me always deeper into the underbrush of my dense psychic bramble. I lived embarrassed in the theatrical darkness and dreamt of standing proud in the cinematic light. I recently went to a Hollywood party at which I wholly belonged. This was one of those Los Angeles affairs at which people who have been friends for years sniff cautiously at one another for recent changes in status. The celebration poured into the night, boozing and schmoozing. Stars shook hands and traded compliments and greeted fans, and I straddled both worlds fairly comfortably. Some fans approached me and gushed a little awkwardly. I approached some celebrities of whom I am a fan and did my best not to gush awkwardly. It was a party at which I had every right to be. Roseanne punched me in the arm and called me hun like a waitress at a Georgia diner. It was that kind of party. I found myself, very late in the evening, sipping scotch on the rocks through a hollow plastic stir stick, watching the milling crowd. I stood against the wall, observing the behavior of the partiers in a quiet spiral of Raskolnikov's self-absorption, taking in the subtextual details of observed conversations from behind a safe, warm lens of amber liquid. After a while, a young woman came and stood against the wall near me. She was old enough to have moved to Los Angeles chasing a dream, young enough that I could imagine charming her, teasing out any daddy issues I might exploit. Then she said, "What are you doing over here?" I thought about it for a moment and then said, "I'm writing a story for you." Some people nearby heard me and began to shift toward us. Perhaps some of them recognized my voice from public radio. Perhaps some of them knew who I was and thought it would be interesting to hear what it was like when I stood at the side of a room and wrote a story for a young woman. Perhaps the scotch had led me to blurt it out a little too loudly, an impromptu announcement that I was about to perform inappropriately at a party. She said, "A story for me?" I knew, as we became a small focal point in the celebrationscape, that I could have asked her name, given her a chance to talk about herself while we had focus, turned over the spotlight to this hopeful, attractive young woman. But I'm not that guy. I said, yes, a story for you. I don't have all the fibers worked out yet, but it's about how we all have to strive to be the opposite of the Highlander. That had her. It had all the listeners. It was just too odd a premise to leave hanging. When I was in college, I told her, I wore a sword around the Sarah Lawrence campus as a fashion accessory. I imagined that it made me look very heroic and dashing and not at all stupid. Apparently, I felt the T-shirt that said, I have phallic insecurity, was over the top. It was during that time that I met Ted Impellizzeri. He was a year younger than I, a talented opera singer. The day that we met on a grassy lawn, moments after we'd been introduced, he and I began to wrestle in slow motion. It was a theatrical act of bonding and male dominance and status play, but it was also wholly controlled and entirely friendly. We worked through arm bars and takedowns and reversals, all in perfectly executed cooperative improvisation, supporting one another's weight when necessary, and amazing the mutual friends who had just introduced us. We were immediately as close as any two young men can be. We spent all of our time together through my years in college until I graduated and then moved to Los Angeles, and he got married and moved to Colorado and had a kid. He was a basso profundo, but I had no idea just how low he could get until news came to me that, disappointed with the places life had taken him, he threw himself off a cliff. I remember hanging out in the green room at the Central before it became the Viper Room, doing lines off the black glass coffee table with Bobby Pastorelli, and stumbling out onto Sunset at sunrise with nothing to show for our night's endeavors but red eyes and tense jaws, and I remember him telling me that all he needed was one good role to prove himself and nothing could stop him. And then he got cast on Murphy Brown and stopped taking my calls, and then he was gone. And Sam Kinison kept going on stage on Blow and kept trying to find a way to come down until he went off the road outside Needles, and Mitch Hedberg and Bill Hicks is gone, and Greg Giraldi and Richard Jenny and Drake Sather, who I resented for years because I perceived him as having stolen my career, called his wife and let her listen over the phone as he pulled the trigger, and Joe Bodelei and Alan Kirshenbaum, and there is a litany of loss to which I rock myself to sleep at night. Talented, funny people all who chased their dreams and then, awakened by the kiss of fair fortune, found themselves dissatisfied with the glamour, heartbroken by its insubstantial nature. It's occurred to me, at last, that the notion that there can be only one is an adolescent fantasy of solitary self-aggrandizement. The truth is, there is room for so many more than we imagine. We do not draw strength from the loss of our colleagues and our friends. Art is not a zero-sum game, and we gain strength when we lend it. When we support one another, we add to the whole. When we recognize and acknowledge our own weakness, we stand a chance of gaining support when and where we need it. It is my hope, I told the girl at the party, that if I can write the story that points to that truth, if I can shatter some of the romantic illusions you carry with you, just maybe you can walk into your career with the strength and the joy of the disenchanted, and you won't ever have to die of disappointment. The group about us had begun to shift uncertainly because this diatribe was not the light entertainment they had hoped for when they gathered to hear my story. This was not the bright yarn they had expected me to spin, but something much heavier. The girl was not aware of that, though. She did not have my experience reading a crowd, feeling their rhythm and their mood. All she knew was that my focus was on her, and the small crowd's focus was on me. And maybe that meant that I was someone up to whom she should suck. So she said, what's your name? I thought about the time I had spent toiling away in my office building up a shelf of screenplays and pilots. I thought about my tight 5 hours of material, nothing but setup and punchline. I said, Rumpelstiltskin. Trying to banter well above her weight class, she said, aren't you supposed to keep your name a secret? I said, not in this town, kid. The people around us laughed a little too heavily, received a little too loudly, relieved that I had found my way to a punchline. I looked down casually into my drink and spun my straw, and I was golden.
Wow, that was just beautiful,
awesome.
Dylan.
Thank you very much.
Listen, I have to tell you, you draw people into your stories like no other storyteller has ever done on our show.
Aww.
And I think here's what it is, Hannes, here's what it is. He's a humorist more than a storyteller, and here's how you know. The cufflinks.
Right. He is dressed in a very classy, sort of steampunky yet classy way. Sort of, you could be 1890 around
There's
you.
There's something about the wardrobe that adds to your whole...
Yeah, but that was like the structure was perfect.
Well, perfect.
It's like, because inside the, it's like you're drawing her inside the story and you're drawing us into the story just like the character that you're talking to. By the way, did you get anywhere with that girl? That's all I care about.
I was already married by the time I met her.
So you were just practicing.
At this point, yeah, all the flirtations in which I indulge are just for the sake of feeling attractive and not for the sake of actually getting anywhere.
Yeah, and I really like what you have to say about art and everyone rising, you know, helping one another to make the... It's you know, for podcasting, I love that there's a lot of podcasts now. We sort of, you know, raise up the water together.
There is a community of artists in L.A. of which... I was either unaware in the 80s and early 90s or that just didn't exist mm-hmm. at the time. That may be because in the 80s and early 90s, the only reason people gathered was in hope that somebody else could afford cocaine.
Yeah.
How many years were you caught up in that trap?
Oh, man. I was stoned from the time I was 16 to the time I was 32.
Okay, so a good period of time.
Yes. I did a lot of cocaine... From 85 to 88.
Oh, that's interesting. Those were my years of cocaine.
Well,
it was like 85, 86, 87.
I'm amazed that I didn't do cocaine then.
To be older than you appear.
I'm 48.
You are significantly older than you appear.
Wait.
That is a compliment. That's a compliment.
That's a very good thing.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. But apparently I need to practice more with people with whom I won't get anywhere because it didn't read when I said it to her.
Well, you are married. I see your ring. I'm looking at your ring.
I am married.
Yes. And how long have you been married?
It will be 20 years next summer.
Oh, that's very beautiful.
But nobody's married in the studio. That's what we all say.
Is that the rule?
Yes, the rule. It's like Vegas, yeah.
What happens on the broadcasting microphone stays on... Hey, wait a minute.
What is this goop?
Often asks me to take one for the team, and I don't think that that's appropriate at all.
I don't...
Look, you're the guy our guests keep asking you out, and you keep saying no.
So I just think it's like a big love fest, the entire thing about, you know, trying to celebrate one another's talent in art. And I love the idea that it's boundless. I mean, there is to it.
But not only podcasting, but the internet, like all this technology has freed up the idea because you were like, there's not one. It used to be when there were three networks and there's 12 sitcoms on the air, it's like that was it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the outlet for your creativity, and now you have other outlets.
To some degree, I think this whole idea of the podcast, and we all create our own outlets, and Amanda Palmer with her crowdsourcing and saying everyone should start crowdsourcing like me, because as long as you have 1 million fans, it'll be easy, is really just the latest extension of the myth that I talk about.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's another way to get people to work for free. There's a thing that I keep thinking about putting into this story and haven't put in because I feel it's a little off topic and might be worthy of its own story. We talk all the time about the entertainment industry. And on the East Coast, and I come from a background of academic intellectuals and artists, and on the East Coast, we talk all the time about art. And then artists come to L.A. hoping to ply their trade, not realizing that the entertainment industry has no understanding of art. I think of entertainment as the word people use when they don't want to take responsibility for what they are saying through art. And industry, of course, is the manufacture of something for sale and profit.
Yeah.
So the entertainment industry is people who want to manufacture irresponsible art for sale and profit. And they will eat through artists who come in as craftsmen who are willing to ply their trade without thinking about what
they're
saying.
I know, but isn't that the beauty of everything being on a consumer level, that now you can shoot your own thing, edit your own thing, put up your own podcast... Do your, you know.
First of all, if you've ever shot your own thing, I think we all know how painful that can be.
Exactly.
No, because even with in the world of the internet, I create things that I think are beautiful, and I perform live and I shoot it and I put it on the internet, and my 2,000 fans look at it and go, "Hey, this is great," and maybe some of them repost it. But unless I have, I don't know if I'm allowed to list the other sort of known networks on the internet on your show.
That's
but
fine.
Unless I have Funny or Die behind me pushing it, or the Sideshow Network, or the Young
Turks
Television.
But Dylan, it's all a process. I mean, nobody gets it out of the gate anyway. I mean, it's all a process. So, well, 2,000 fans is better than 500.
It is, and yet. 2000. I went for a meeting with a big deal record producer. I've done 5 CDs with Stand Up Records, and I was ready to try someone else because Stand Up Records wasn't doing some of the things I wanted them to do in promotion and so on. And I had a meeting with a big deal record producer who said, "You're very talented. I love your work. I could love your work enormously. I'm still not going to make your record until you have 350,000 fans and followers."
Right.
Because I made a record for this woman who is talentless. She cannot sing. But I only did it because I knew because her husband...
She would get people out,
she
yes.
would be able to sell
okay,
the record.
Okay, we understand this, right?
This is it's all about profit. So the quality of the work does not translate into having a large audience. And the people who can get you to a large audience, and it does require that... corporate push to get
I know,
to a large
but
it, audience.
But that's like saying there's good music and bad music and only the music on the radio is from talented people. That's not true.
No, it is not like saying that. It is like saying there is good music and there is bad music. There is successful music and there is unsuccessful music.
Mm-hmm.
Financially successful music. And the two are in no way connected. The quality of the art has nothing to do with its chance of success.
Well, that's what I mean. And so that's what I'm saying. So that the milk does rise to the top. The cream rises to the top. So you just have to...
I think you're using different definitions of top. Because it's like, there's one category where it's the most artistically successful and one where it's the most financially successful. And on occasion, an artistically successful song... will also be financially successful, but it's not. But it can be the other way around as well.
If the cream rose to the top, we would not have 10 seasons of CSI and Criminal Minds and.
I see what you're saying. Okay, right.
Well, in fact, the Rubicon gets 2 seasons and then disappears.
Well, listen, I recently got rid of satellite TV, and one of the things I've learned from getting rid of my satellite television is how much more there is out there. Because now I go on to, Crackle.com, and I'm on Hulu Plus, and I'm on Netflix, of course, and so there's all these different outlets, and you realize that what the networks have been feeding people doesn't have to be.
While that's true, you have just listed 3 hugely well-funded corporations.
Right.
Any of which I cannot get onto without having a manager set up a meeting and then them figure out not whether or not my work is good, but whether or not they can profit
from
it.
Can sell it. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which means that the cream is not rising from the top to the top. The most marketable is rising
well,
to the top.
Well, I guess to me, though, it enables somebody who has stick-to-itiveness and somebody who has the, wherewithal to, if you, as it were, want it that bad, sooner or later, you're going to work at every avenue you have to do. You're going to play the Twitter game or play the Facebook game or whatever you have to do. And then, if you do it long enough and hard enough, it will pay off.
First of all, I like hearing you say do it long enough and hard enough.
I know,
secondly,
right?
No discussion is too intellectual for a good dick joke. That's what I always like to say.
I feel that's true.
Yes,
I
exactly.
will always, seeing the opportunity, I
right.
will always go there.
Jump to it.
That idea that stick-to-itiveness is what is necessary is part of the mythology.
Okay.
And it saddens me and it's heartbreaking. But ultimately, we have to let go of our whole definition of success and redefine for ourselves. Because I feel as though I am doing some of the best work of my life right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I am moving farther and farther away from what is likely to get me on late night television.
Hmm.
I am moving farther and farther into dark places and difficult places and truths that are hidden by our righteously repressed Victorian society and so on. And that means that I have to be able to define my success in terms of self-expression, in terms of beauty of language, in terms of response by those who hear it, rather than in terms of numbers.
Yeah.
And because we live in a capitalist society, it is very difficult to remember that success is not always indicated by capital.
Can I just say that that made me think of, because in a way, yes, it's like, I feel that way too. It's like sometimes I'm just, on the rare occasion, it used to be more often that I would have like 3 auditions in a day. And just the mere fact that I was driving through Los Angeles in the sun, listening to Garth Brooks in my pickup truck, when I had a pickup truck, going to auditions, I was like, I'm happy right now doing this. My definition is, I don't live in Milwaukee anymore. I don't work in an office. I'm going to auditions.
And so
it's like, I want to get the job, but the mere fact that I was doing it was a definition of success for me.
But you felt good coming here today as well, right?
Right, exactly. Well, not in the traffic on the fucking 405. It's a nightmare. Okay, sorry.
And also, the Garth Brooks in the pickup truck, this is not adding up.
That was back in the, that was back in the old days. Now I drive a Volvo and I listen to Enya. No, that's too old,
too. But Dylan and Hannes, but my point is that... I don't have a point. No, my point is that just to live in Los Angeles and just be, because I feel like you do, Hannes.
Yeah.
I don't live in Pittsburgh. I live in a sunny place. I play tennis 3 or 4 days a week. It's free. And I hike every day in the park, and that's free. And I have
right.
a child.
Yeah, your definition cannot only be, I got a network. And I think this goes into what Dylan is saying. It's like, it's your own definition
ultimately,
of what is
ultimately
making
you have
you happy.
To be able to define your own success.
Yeah.
Because as long as it is defined culturally, you are going to be falling short.
The problem is, though, is trying to make a living at it. And I know this by Storyworthy. I've been doing this show for over 3.5 years. And I spend about, 20 hours a week working on this show. That's what I do. And the money, it does not pay off yet. I think it will. But, it's a constant struggle. So it's sort of like I have to do without. I don't have a big house. I don't have a lot of things.
Well, here's a thing. It's not necessarily the thing, but here's a thing that it took me a long time.
Here's a thing. That's what she said. Sorry, we didn't have a dick joke for a while. I had to throw one in there. Okay.
I appreciate you throwing in your dick. Yes. Wait, what?
What's happening?
What? Hang on. Just hit the table. Go ahead.
If only we had a Steve Allen Bell.
Yes, hang on.
Here's a thing.
Steve Allen.
Nobody feels successful. Nobody. The guys that you were talking about earlier who are making a living, who are you see on TV, and Spencer Garrett, and the people who do guest appearances all the time, and you always go, oh, it's that guy. I think of them as successful actors. They think of themselves as not yet having made it, but they're making a living as an actor, so that's good, but they haven't made it yet.
No.
The people who have TV series for 2 years feel as though this is good. This is a great step in my career, but it doesn't mean anything until we've got enough for syndication.
No, I agree.
In syndication feel as though it doesn't mean anything because they just had that one TV series it's not. I have a dear friend who is I think of as a very successful comic and writer and producer, and sometimes he's being an absolute dick to me. And I finally realized those are the days that he's worried about money. I went to see the taping last year of Roseanne's beautiful new pilot, and it was rejected by the network because...
Mary Birdsong was in that.
Yes. It was beautiful. It was written by Eric Gilliland. It was freaking Norman Lear worthy. And she doesn't feel like she's made it because while she has barrels of money stored, whatever people with money do, I don't know how that works. But
according to Breaking Bad, you put it in barrels and bury it in the desert.
Okay. While she has barrels of money buried in the desert, she cannot get a guarantee on a series without first doing a pilot, and then as her destination.
No, I understand. It's an ongoing process, and there is no final destination. There is no way to say, now I'm here, because everything gets canceled. Right. Even Seinfeld got canceled. So there's going to be an end to every project.
But I agree with what he says in that, because that's similar to something after that, which is, it's the idea of how you're framing it, because people... Like our old acting teacher, Brian Reese, who
people
we love.
People do like your old acting
They
teacher,
do. Exactly. No, he would say there are maybe 3 to 5 people in Hollywood at any moment who don't have to audition and everybody else is.
But
and
only like, 3. Yeah, like
yeah,
3
at
people.
At some point, Tom Cruise and Tom Hanks could do any single thing they wanted in Hollywood. They can still do a lot more than most people, but they have both come down from being at the top of the mountain.
The only way you get a part without auditioning is if you're Brad Pitt and you put yourself
you're Brad
in
Pitt
your
in
own movie.
In 2001.
Well, no,
not
he just put
now.
Himself
you're
in 12 Years a Slave.
Producing your own movie, exactly.
He just put himself in that movie with, I think he used 5 or 6 accents during that one scene. It was very complicated.
See, we had this discussion during the Oscars, and you were among the people who was like, why is Brad Pitt in this movie? And I said, because he couldn't get the money from Hollywood. He had to get foreign money. And they were like, my friend, if you do not appear on screen, I'm not giving you the money. I guarantee you that's why he's in it for 12
minutes. It's just as soon as I see him, I think, why is Brad Pitt in 1841?
Yeah.
That's all. I just find it odd.
Was it Shelley Winters, I want to say? It's Hollywood mythology. I think it's Shelley Winters. Who went into an audition, was called in for an audition, pulled her Oscar out of her purse, set it on the desk, and said, okay, you want me to read?
Wow.
Yes,
awesome.
I've heard that story. That's great.
That's
a
great story.
Yeah.
Well, and there's also the person who wins the Oscar, and they get to the after party, and they get into the VIP lounge, but Tom Cruise just left.
Yeah.
So there's never going to be, you're never going to be there. Although I will say this, one time I was at a fancy Hollywood party, I walk into the bathroom, and you know what I see? Sharon Stone doing cocaine.
Nice.
So I got that going for me.
Excellent.
Not mythology. That happened.
No, it's a good
Chateau
story.
Chateau Marmont, thank you.
Well, if you're at parties at the Chateau Marmont, that's what that place is for.
You want to play some Shotgun Storyworthy?
I would love to play some Shotgun Storyworthy.
Music can only mean one thing. It's time for Shotgun Storyworthy.
The game where our storyteller spins the storyworthy wheel of truth and tells a true 1-minute story about the topic it lands on.
So everybody, say it with me.
Spin that wheel!
Ah, passport. Having pulled passport as the topic of this story, I will tell the tale of coming back from England when I lived there. I lived in England for a year studying theater at the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art because I am very pompous and very fancy. And on the way back, because I am neurotic, I tend to fiddle with things and indulge constantly in tactile sensations around me. And on the plane, also I was a little bit nervous about flying at the time, plus I had hash in my pocket, so that was making me more nervous. I was fiddling with my passport, and the lamination began to separate, and I could feel the stickiness of the underside of the lamination against my thumb as I was, and it didn't occur to me that this was going to be a problem. And coming through into the U.S., they asked to see my passport, and it had peeled down far enough that the corner of the photograph was exposed, which made them think that perhaps I had a fraudulent passport, and they wanted to immediately search all of my luggage and everything that I owned, as a result of which I said, well, okay, and using my coffee, I swallowed far too large a block of black hash to avoid having it on my person as they searched through my luggage and then searched in internal parts of my body. And thought, you know, I left the airport feeling like, oh, good, I got by. I managed that beautifully. And then halfway from the airport to Manhattan, I was coming from JFK, the way too much black hash hit my system all at once. And I asked the driver apparently 10 or 12 times how long we had been in the car. Because my sense of time was all messed up. And I felt it was very urgent that I get a new passport. So I stopped for a new passport photo on the walk right down the block from where I was staying in Manhattan. And for years, I had a passport with a photo of me looking confused and grinning and slanty-eyed, squinty-eyed, because I was stoned out of my mind and certain that it was urgent that I get the photo taken just then.
Wow, that, you know what's so great about that story, Hannes,
yeah,
is it was so literal. I mean, it was about his passport.
Yes.
Oh, but it was a minute and 40 seconds too long. I have never told a story.
You son of a bitch, mother.
It was a great story.
Will you edit out every third word?
Here's the thing with a passport is you really are committed to like a 10-year picture.
Yes. Yes, and that was not a good photo of me.
Yeah, that's a tough thing.
That was the photo of me where it looked like I had been photographed...
like a mugshot.
In the reflection of a car door, on a car door.
Yeah,
as a drug bust is going down.
My eyes were squinting.
Oh, that's hilarious. Can I just say, I wanted to bring this up before. You are a frequent contributor to the show Off Ramp.
Yes, I am.
And if you're around the country and you don't hear Off Ramp, go online and find it's KPCC in mm-hmm. Pasadena. It is... one of the best shows on
quality
radio.
Program.
I love that show.
Well, and, I will tell John you said so
on
the pseudo-air.
The pseudo-air, yes.
Listen,
yes.
Dylan, just to go back to
Christine.
Just to go back to your drug use.
Anything, I'm happy
now,
to...
I know that you used to live on the roof of the Comedy Store.
I did. How do you know that?
Because I've looked into you.
Some of my work.
And I know that you were really homeless for a period of time.
Yes, I didn't realize it at the time. But
you were.
Yes.
And you prostituted yourself.
Yes, I did. I did not realize that.
How do you think you bought
either.
Those cufflinks?
And,
that's blowjob cufflink
but
right
listen,
there.
You were hanging out with Sam Kinison and that crew.
Sort of. I was at the outer edge of his entourage.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I disagreed with his politics. So when he was desperate for company and he needed a lot of people around him, I would be invited to the party at his house. And one of my most vivid memories of him is him standing on a step from his living room up to the hallway out of his house, preventing me from leaving, screaming at me, "I'm the party goalie!
Do
nobody
you know,
leaves to do all the blows,
I
guys.
Had that happen with Christina Ricci. Right. I had her corner me in her house and say, "You can't leave.
You can't leave. I need you.
I swear to God. I had that
happen.
That is so
weird.
Strange. Okay. Yeah, I had that happen.
Sam Kinison. Now, I'm glad you mentioned him again. I knew Sam Kinison.
So did
you
I.
You, sir, are no Sam Kinison. No. His brother, Bill Kinison,
yes.
owned the first club I ever worked at regularly in Madison, Wisconsin, the Comedy Cellar.
Nice.
So Sam was our first out-of-town big-shot headliner. Now, he was not famous yet.
He walked
He
room.
Was a year away from being on Letterman. And we, as punk-ass kids, were like, this guy's fucking hilarious. If he would just tone it down a little bit, maybe he could be successful. And then all of a sudden, he becomes a giant superstar. Well, but he was out of his fucking mind. He's a nice man, out of his mind.
Well, yeah. Here was the thing about that era and Sam Kinison. Sam was one of what I refer to as the right-wing rebels.
Mm-hmm.
It was Sam and Andrew Dice Clay, and there were a few others working at the time, who believed that they came out of the tradition of Lenny Bruce and George Carlin because they said fuck a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And because they spoke from their hearts. But their hearts were in a horrible place. So Sam wrote really, really funny material. But when you really look at the material, and again, art always says something, and you have to be aware of what you're saying, or you're just an entertainer and you're not taking responsibility. And when you look at what he was saying, he blamed women for violence against women. He blamed gays for AIDS. He blamed the poor for their own poverty. It was all very right-wing thinking.
Yeah,
he was from Texas. It was very Texas kind of thing.
And it was Dice Clay was doing much the same thing, although I once saw him. I saw him before he became famous, and he did something that was fairly brilliant that we can talk about if you want. But Kinison, I argued with him about gay rights at one point in his house, and then I became much less welcome there unless he was having a big party and really wanted to
Yeah, you're a fringe person. Now, he got hit by a drunk driver, by the way. He didn't just...
I thought that was the ultimate irony that he was killed by somebody who was impaired. That was Jesus going, I got to take you out.
Jeez, Hannes, that's tough, man.
I don't mean take you out. I meant like, it's like you... How many times had Sam Kinison's impairment put other people in danger.
Right. And
that he was taken out by somebody else is like, that's just irony.
There is some doubt in my mind as to whether this time he was clean as...
Well, it doesn't matter. There was a kid in a pickup truck.
But he wasn't driving. So even if he was blasted...
But there's also some question as to whether he was driving at the time. But none of that matters because what the mention of him in that is really about all the loss of people who were lost in one way or another. And even without dying, he was lost to me. Years before that, because he was so desperate for anything that could make him feel less self-loathing.
Dylan, when did you become clean, as it were, and did you go through a program?
I did not go through a program. In 90, I want to say 94, 95. I may be wrong about that. If someone wants to do the math, I was born in 69. It was when I was 32. I went into a depression shortly after I got married. I've been depressed many times over the course of my life.
And how many men have said that?
But I'm bummed.
My wife said to me, you know, Dylan, you have to talk to somebody because you're absorbing all the light in the apartment. And I went into therapy. And 2 weeks after I went into therapy, I said, I'm thinking about studying martial arts. And I had always been non-athletic. And I signed up for a martial arts class, and within 6 months, I quit smoking cigarettes.
Wow. So the discipline of that.
And within a year, I quit smoking pot.
Yeah.
And recently, I had a dream in which I just kept... Because occasionally, I will try to hit a pot at a party. It doesn't freak me out to have hit a pot, although several times it has caused me to black out. I have a vasovagal reaction if I'm standing up when I get high now.
Oh, wow.
So I have to be sitting down and know I'm going to be sitting down for a while.
Well, we can go out to my car later.
That's good to know. Thank you. But I recently had a dream in which I told myself, dude, you're an addict.
Yeah.
Because someone had given me some pot and it freaked me out for a week and a half.
I had it
in my house. And all week I was like, I could get high now. Should I get high now? I shouldn't get high now. I could get high now.
You just thought about it.
Yeah, all the time. And then I finally just had to give it away.
Do you drink alcohol?
Yes.
Interesting.
Not
Listen,
heavily.
I am so happy you're here. And I'm so
happy that
you're
here.
In the world to bring the talent that you do. And you truly are a savant with the language.
Thank you. I appreciate that no end. I like to believe that I am good at what I do. But the truth of the matter is I just strive every day to suck marginally less than I did the day before.
And you know what? That's a good trajectory.
Yeah. Yeah. Ever decreasing suckiness.
All right, you guys, we got to wrap it up on that note. And you can find Dylan Brody on Twitter at Dylan Brody. And of course, read his blog and his amazing words at dylanbrody.com.
And you can hear him on Off Ramp.
And you can hear him on, you can hear him on the Storyworthy podcast.
Right. Well, more importantly, yes.
All right, you guys.
May I say my most recent novel, Laughs Last, available at Amazon.
Oh, of course.
I almost brought you a copy, but then there weren't any in my car.
Oh, well, thank you, though. Last Laughs.
Blurbs from Carl Reiner and Paul Krasner, and it's a good, good book.
Oh, we'll enjoy that. Thank you, Dylan. All right, you guys, on behalf of everybody here at Sideshow Network, including Anthony Bench and Sean Merrick, and of course, our storyteller tonight, Dylan Brody, and you, Hannes Finney, my dear friend and co-host, my name is Christine Blackburn. Blackburn saying, make it a story worthy week.
Thanks for joining us on the Story Worthy podcast. We'll be back next week with all new stories. Subscribe to Storyworthy on iTunes and visit the Storyworthy website at storyworthypodcast.com.
If you like listening to comedy, try watching it on the internet. The folks behind the Sideshow Network have launched a new YouTube channel called Wait For It. It's got interviews with comedians like Reggie Watts, Todd Glass, applies to Schlesinger. Schlesinger, I've been friends with her for 10 years. One of the funniest people out there, and I still have a hard time with the last name, Liza. Our very own Owen Benjamin, that's me, takes you on a musical journey down internet rabbit holes and much more. You don't have to wait any longer. Just go to youtube.com/waitforitcomedy. There's no need to wait for it anymore because it's here and it's funny. And I love you.